Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.
Before today, this country had never watched a former president stand trial on criminal charges. We didn't know what that would look like or feel like. But today, we found out. And in addition to the spectacle of it, there was a little bit of a spectacle, not as much as there could have been. A lot actually happened during day one of Donald Trump's trial here in New York City. We're going to break it all down over the course of the next hour, and we have the perfect people, absolutely the perfect ones to do it with. Former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, Pete Perrara, has been in these courtrooms. He understands the calculations being made by the prosecutors about everything from jury selection to evidence to gag orders, things we all heard a lot about today. Norm Eisen investigated Donald Trump during his first impeachment. He literally wrote the book on this New York case, and he was at the courthouse today for the trial. And Congressman Dan Goldman was a prosecutor in New York and worked with both Manhattan D.A. Alvin Bragg and Trump defense attorney Todd Blanche. But I do want to start tonight with the scene that unfolded today in Lower Manhattan, one that was both extraordinary and kind of ordinary all at the same time. I mean, on the one hand, a former president of the United States faced the start of his criminal trial, which was historic. Who knew we would get here? We were skeptical at times, and it was almost surreal. I mean, helicopters tracked his every movement as he left his motorcade, left Trump Tower, and arrived at the courthouse downtown. And of course, cameras rolled while Trump, predictably, used his entrance and exit as a way of speaking past the courtroom and straight to his supporters, not even being truthful when he did that. So that was all kind of different, kind of extraordinary. And so are the charges. A former president accused of falsifying business records in a scheme to unlawfully influence the outcome of an election. But on the other hand, in many ways, what we saw today was also very ordinary. A guy who's facing 34 felony counts had his day in court, as any defendant in this country is entitled to have. He walked into the same dark, dingy halls of that New York courthouse, just like so many accused criminals have done before. Sat at the same table as all of those other defendants. He had legal representation, as is his right. He faced a judge, answered some direct questions as they were asked, and soon he will face a jury of his peers. In that sense, today, Donald Trump was beholden to the same rules and norms that govern the rest of us. According to reporters in the room, Trump even closed his eyes for a period of time. He might have been thinking, might have been sleeping, but I mean, who among us hasn't done that? So at the end of the day, Trump may have wanted a circus outside of that courtroom, but inside, it was more ordinary than extraordinary. The rule of law trumped the spectacle, and we saw that right from the jump. Today was billed as jury selection. That was going to be the focus. It was the focus of today, and we'll talk about that. That is a lot of what we were expecting to see. Before we got anywhere close to that point, we saw a flurry of motions and activity. Judge Merchan began the day by refusing to recuse himself in response to Trump's request for him to do so. He also warned Trump that he could face jail if he misses court without a reason. Judge Merchan also made several crucial calls about what evidence will and will not be allowed during the trial. For example, the infamous Access Hollywood tape, you know, that one where Trump brags about groping women, that one, we all remember that. That cannot be played for jurors, but prosecutors can use a transcript of the tape. What does that mean? And testimony from Michael Cohen's guilty plea to campaign finance violations is allowed, but prosecutors cannot imply that Trump is guilty just because Cohen was. The judge also set a hearing for next week on the gag order against Trump after prosecutors argued today that he violated the order. Today. They're also asking the judge to sanction Trump $1,000 for each of three posts, tell him to take them down and to warn him that another post could put him in jail. And after all that, jury selection began. So while yes, because of the ordinary nature of this trial, this court and this judge had to deal with a whole lot of extra motions, and they had to deal with a whole lot of extra potential jurors, but the big lesson learned today is that they did, in fact, deal with all of it. The court system can do this. Donald Trump walked in, had his first day in criminal court, walked out, and tomorrow he will be right back at that table at 9:30 a.m. After months, years of disappointments, delay tactics, I mean, boy, have the wheels of justice turned slowly at times, am I right? But today, one of the most effective obfuscators of justice was brought to trial, and he will stay there until a verdict is reached. Starting us off tonight is Preet Bharara. He's the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York. It's great to be here with you. You've been in these courtrooms. You know what it's like to
have
this strategy.
From time to time.
So let's just start with your big takeaway from the events of today.
Look, I think it's important to take a moment, like you did in your intro, to consider what an extraordinary situation this is. After all the delays, after all the whining, after all the motion practice, with three of the four cases delayed, some because of the Supreme Court, some because of an ethics question in Georgia, you have an actual criminal case that's proceeding. You might say you have eventually, the peaceful transition to accountability, which is not a small thing. You have literally a defendant with Secret Service agents to protect him in tow in a Manhattan courtroom in state court facing the music. And also finding it reportedly so mundane, or maybe he's so tired from preparation that he closed his eyes and apparently maybe fell asleep. That's a big deal, you know, because people have been concerned that accountability is not forthcoming. It is here. And, you know, he was the former president of the United States, commander in chief. He may be again. He's aspiring to that again. But he couldn't hide in some oligarch's cabin somewhere. He doesn't have his own army. And the fact that he can be brought to justice, the United States of America, notwithstanding his former standing and his potential future standing, I think says something good and right about the rule of law.
Yes, the slow wheels of justice, but they started today, and we can feel good about that. I went through some of this, and I think a lot of us are trying to figure out what to make of it. I mean, because there was a lot of discussion about what evidence was admissible and what evidence was not. So I want to go through some of that and just see how it struck you. The Access Hollywood tape I mentioned. So they can't play the tape, but they can use the transcript. Why? And what does that mean?
So that's a good question. And I have the same question. It's a little bit peculiar. I mean, one thing you have to realize that in all cases, but certainly in a case that the whole world is watching and scrutinizing and will be especially scrutinized by an appellate court if there's a conviction here, is that the judge wants to tread carefully and make sure that his rulings are sound and within his discretion, and he's never found to have abused his discretion. And you know, one could have argued, I think not poorly, that the entire Access Hollywood business should not have come in.
At all.
You could make the argument, Trump's team made the argument, even though it's probative, for the idea that they were so freaked out by this tape that came out, they wanted to quell, disclosure of this relationship, so they made the payoff. I think a judge could have decided not to let that in for fear of that being something that was reversible on appeal. What I don't understand, and I think lay people and lawyers alike don't fully understand, is, you know, what is the prejudicial difference between allowing in the transcript and every single word that was uttered versus the tape? In fact, because the tape itself doesn't have, it's not a videotape of Donald Trump, it's an audio tape. So they have one but not the other. I'm not sure why that makes a lot of sense.
I guess I feel better that there's not a clarity of answer
but
there.
He was giving one. He was giving one to the defense. And the record will show, and we'll go through some of the other things you might ask me about in a second. When a record shows that a judge seems to be going down the middle and finding in his or her discretion for the prosecution sometimes, for the defense sometimes, that sets a record on appeal of showing that this person wasn't single-mindedly trying to screw the defense or screw the prosecution or vice versa. So I think it's a reasonably good record so far.
The other piece, and it was the Michael Cohen of it all, which feels like the Michael Cohen of it all could be a theme of the next several weeks, where some testimony on guilty plea was allowed, but they can't imply Trump is guilty just because Cohen was, which again, to a layperson and a non-lawyer, you're thinking, wait, Michael Cohen went to jail for this thing that Trump actually participated in. How is that not the case? And how is that not admissible in court?
Well, the fact of the guilty plea is admissible for other reasons, but it's long been a black letter law that just because someone else in a conspiracy has pled guilty to something, you don't want that to be imputed to the person who's on trial, right? You have to separately prove in a separate proceeding with separate, trial evidence and separate witnesses that the person who's on trial is guilty. You know, but it does have arguably some spillover effect because jurors, although it can't be argued to the jury, jurors will say, well, wait a minute, you have a, you know, a nucleus of facts about which this other person was convicted and found guilty in some other court. That means that a crime was committed, and they might think this maybe applies to Trump. But they're going to be, I think, instructions to the jury that they can't consider that for that purpose. And the judge rightly determined under the law that you can't consider that for that purpose. But it's a double-edged sword, right? Because on the one hand, maybe it's helpful to prosecutors because some guy was convicted of a crime that maybe proves that there was a crime. On the other hand, there's a witness who was convicted of a crime. And among the crimes he was convicted of was lying. And who are you going to believe now? This lying witness who was convicted. So I think it's a big question about how Michael Cohen will be perceived.
I mean, Donald Trump had the sex the hush money was paid for, as an average non-lawyer person, as how I read it. But we will see how this all plays out. I want to ask you about jury selection. That was obviously a big part of the factor today. You have been a big part of jury selection in the past. There's a lot of strategy involved here. There's a couple things that happened that stuck out. I mean, half the first panel of 96 prospective jurors was dismissed after they said they could not be fair and impartial. They could have lied. Maybe they're being honest. Of course, that's a good thing. There's also a jury questionnaire that was lengthy and asked a lot of questions about people's media consumption. Did anything stick out to you about the questionnaire or the number of people who recused themselves today?
I think it's a down-the-middle questionnaire. I think, you know, most of the questions of the 42 were agreed upon by consensus by both the prosecution and the defense. There's a subset of questions that there was no agreement on, and the judge, I think, made a good determination about what those questions should be and how they should be phrased. You don't usually see scores of people in the first round say they can't be fair. And I, you know, you said something a second ago that I think is worthy of further comment. You know, presumably there are dozens of people in the jury veneer in the pool who don't like Donald Trump, don't want him to become president, could have decided, well, I'm going to sort of fake my way into the jury, say I'm going to be fair and be part of the process that convicts Donald Trump because maybe it'll hurt him some way politically or otherwise. And they didn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that you have such a significant number of people who decided I'm not going to be part of something that's not appropriate, I'm just going to, you know, absent myself, I think is a good sign about the potential fairness of the trial.
Yeah, that's interesting. And a very interesting take, so I want to talk to you about it. There's a ruling next week on a gag order. And I think the gag order, it's the big question of like $1,000 for each tweet. If they're not going to put him in jail, which seems unlikely, is that really going to prevent him from attacking people in this case he shouldn't be attacking? Like the judge's family, people. What do you think?
I think the gag order is a little bit of a sideshow. There's not a lot of teeth in the gag order. You know, Donald Trump, it would be a big deal for the judge to put Donald Trump in prison for a day or 2 days or 3 days. So he comes up to the edge, crosses over it a little bit, sips a toe over it. I think the real main show is the evidence that's going to be presented at trial.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it's a difficult thing to be a juror in this case. So that if Donald Trump steps over the line with respect to jurors, which I think he won't do, he's not that stupid, then you'll see, I think, a conflagration. But when he does this sort of, you know, parrying and making fun of people around the judge's circle or the court, which specifically he's allowed to do, I think he'll get away with it.
All things we're watching. They'll be back tomorrow. Preet Bharara, thank you as always for joining me. Really appreciate your insights.
Good to be here.
Coming up, what was it like inside that courtroom in downtown Manhattan today? Well, Norm Eisen was there. He's investigated Donald Trump in the past, and he literally wrote the book on this criminal case in New York. Norm is standing by, and he joins me in just 60 seconds.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm excited to share some great news. Both The Saturday Show and The Sunday Show are available as a podcast. Every weekend, I look forward to bringing you the most important political news and the newsmakers who are creating policies that affect your life. For me, it's all about the conversation. That's when news is revealed and understanding begins. Search for Saturdays and Sundays with Jonathan Capehart and follow.
On the MSNBC podcast, How to Win 2024, political experts former Senator Claire McCaskill and Democratic strategist Jennifer Palmieri examine the campaign strategies unfolding in this all-important election.
The focus is on the voters that are not necessarily in your corner now.
If Democrats are going to win in 2024, we have to be able to explain what is happening at the border and what the solutions are.
Search for How to Win 2024 wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes every Thursday.
Of the four criminal cases that Donald Trump is facing, the New York election interference case is the first to overcome Donald Trump's relentless delay tactics and actually reach trial. It started today. And yet there are still a lot of people out there who have tried to write off this one as the most political or convoluted of the criminal cases that the former president is facing. But as my next guest writes in his new book, just out, about this case, quote, those criticisms are misplaced. Quote, D.A. Bragg has built a robust case along a narrowly tailored theory of prosecution, falsifying business records to conceal criminal conduct that hid damaging information during the 2016 presidential campaign. Proving that Trump knowingly falsified business records will be the crux of the prosecution's case. But based on what we heard in court today, it'll be just as important for the DA to lay out Trump's intent and the full narrative of what he and his campaign did to influence the 2016 election. For instance, prosecutors argued for permission to admit exhibits highlighting the National Enquirer's cozy relationship with the Trump campaign. It's evidence, they say, of Trump's scheme to influence the 2016 election, holding back bad stories. That's pretty much trying to influence. Notably, Judge Mershon ruled that he will allow those exhibits, saying it is, quote, necessary to complete the narrative of what took place. Joining me now is Norm Eisen, the author of this book everybody should buy if they want to learn about the trial. He investigated Donald Trump as the special counsel to the House Judiciary Committee during Trump's first impeachment. He was at the courthouse today, and he literally, as I just said, wrote the book on this case. A Trying Trump, a Guide to His First Election Interference Criminal Trial. Okay, Norm, I don't know if more people know more about this case. Maybe D.A. Bragg knows. I mean, he would probably argue he would. But let me just start by asking you to lay out the arc of what happened in 2016 as kind of a way to explain Trump's motive and intent. This is part of what we heard today. And it was an important reminder to me of all of the details around this.
One of the stunning things about being in court today, Jen, was to see that theory of the case on full display, both in the morning session when the DA laid out a really chronology of election interference, as I say in the title of the book, and then in the afternoon session when the first words of substance that the judge said to the prospective jurors were, this is a case about criminal allegations of election influence in 2016. So both halves were really expressing the narrative that you ask about. It starts in 2015, actually, with a meeting at Trump Tower of David Pecker, the publisher of the National Enquirer, Michael Cohen.
We have his number two guy on later in the show, Lachlan Cartwright. So,
well, I'll have to interview him in the green room for the sequel to my book. So you have David Pecker, you have Donald Trump, and you have Michael Cohen. And this is where prosecutors started this morning on an agreement to influence the 2016 election through catch and kill, that they were, you very seldom get a contract to do election interference. That's what prosecutors alleged happened at that meeting. And then they took a step by step through the proof. This is not just about that illicit campaign payment in October 2016, the benefit to Stormy Daniels. There's a similar catch and kill payment to the doorman, to Karen McDougal. There's the escalating amount of anxiety in the Trump campaign. Despite all of this, the Access Hollywood tape came out. He's worried, the prosecutors argued, his standing with women. And then the payoff, literally, October 2016, an illegal, allegedly illegal campaign contribution that constituted election interference. It kept critical information that the American people had a right to know from them, and in so doing, affected, maybe altered the outcome of the 2016.
We will never know. As somebody who worked in media on campaigns for so long, I mean, this is, it's so important for people to understand this. Paying for stories that are negative about the candidates so that they don't come out into the public, even if they're not fully proven, as some of them weren't entirely, but some of them certainly were. Let me ask you, you were in the courtroom today. I mean, we saw there were no cameras in the courtroom, of course, so we saw reporting from it. But give me a sense of the scene there. Did anything surprise you? What was the general feeling?
Well, I thought it was striking day for the idea of America. Here you have one of the most famous, maybe the most famous person in the country, perhaps the world.
Beyonce might argue.
One of the most powerful and wealthy, has spent tens and tens of millions of dollars to delay this moment. And in spite of all of that, he's forced to appear behind the judge's seat, behind the bench. It says, "In God We Trust," behind him. And it was a moment of trust in the American system that one of the jurors said today. It was so striking, Jed. He was being asked these questions. The judge asks the jurors. They stand up and answer. And he said, I believe no one is above the law, a current president, a former president, or the janitor. And I thought that summarized what the day was about. But no one's below the law either. And Donald Trump is getting his full panoply of rights. It was a very slow day to day. It took much longer. The judge complained at one point, if we go this slowly, we're not going to get our Wednesdays off. So you really saw the genius of the American system at play, but also some of the challenges of bringing these cases to justice.
They come back tomorrow. This is part of the legal process working 9:30 a.m. tomorrow. What are you watching for over the next couple of days? Jury selection, of course.
The tug of war, which is going to start developing as both sides have a half an hour to question each juror. So that is going to be a effort of Donald Trump and his team, led by Todd Blanche, to knock out the typical Manhattan juror and to try to embrace a jury pool that looks like Donald Trump's voters. They're not going to get that in Manhattan, Jen. They want just one angry juror, one juror who won't follow the law, who won't follow the evidence, but who'll be loyal to Donald Trump. But this is a very shrewd judge, a very good prosecution team. They've got, it's the longest list. I've been practicing law for over 30 years. It's the longest list of questions I've ever seen. And the judge is a shrewd judge of character, not just of the law. So I think that checks and balances are there to pick a jury that will honestly adjudicate the facts and the law. If that happens, Donald Trump's in a lot of trouble.
Wow. Norm Eisen, book to read to understand this case. Thank you so much for joining me tonight. I really appreciate it. Congressman Dan Goldman is standing by. He was a prosecutor in New York who worked with both DA Alvin Bragg and Trump's defense attorney, Todd Blanche. I'll get his reaction to day one of Donald Trump's first criminal trial after a very quick break. As Donald Trump's first criminal trial began today in New York City, I couldn't help but think about the remarkable split screen the country is watching play out in real time. It is a presidential election year. On the left, you have Donald Trump, the former commander-in-chief, seated on the defense side of a Manhattan courtroom. On the right, you have the current commander-in-chief, President Biden, in the actual Situation Room, overseeing the response to an Iranian attack against Israel. That's a split screen. Over the next 6 weeks, the contrast between the two candidates running for president is going to be stark. We don't know how Americans will digest it, but it will be quite a difference between the guy sitting in the courtroom and the guy governing the country. Joining me now is Democratic Congressman Dan Goldman of New York. Before getting to Congress, he was an assistant U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York. He is also a former colleague of District Attorney Alvin Bragg and Donald Trump's defense attorney, Todd Blanche. That would be quite a dinner party I would like to attend with you. So let me start here, Congressman, because one of the things that struck me about today is that there's this perception out there that this trial, or there has been, is somehow the most politically helpful to Donald Trump, that it is advantageous to him. But I was kind of impressed by the storytelling a bit and all of the details that were discussed today, some of which I'd even forgotten about. And in a recent poll, 64% of voters say the charges in the hush money trial are at least somewhat serious. We'll see. We don't know how it will impact voters. But if you were talking to a voter, you're an elected official, you're a politician, but you are a former prosecutor, what would you say to them about why this case matters to them?
This case matters because it's about our democracy. It's about whether or not our elections are going to be free and fair and decided ultimately by the people based on the rule of law and election law. And what Donald Trump is alleged to have done is to pay off not one, but two potential different women to silence them from coming out with very damaging information in the weeks before the election. And you'll recall there was that famous Access Hollywood tape, which received significant attention, and Donald Trump received significant blowback for it. So it was clear that if there was one more thing that came out about his poor behavior, so to speak, misconduct with women or otherwise, that would have a damaging effect. And so in order to avoid that, he paid off a porn star, Stormy Daniels, in order to keep her quiet. But he did it in an illegal scheme to cover it up so that no one would know that he did it. And he did it to avoid campaign finance laws. And so you're going to see a sort of summary of all of these things. But this goes to the core heartland of what our elections are about, which is that transparency and following the rule of law is essential to our democracy having free and fair elections.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a through line among some of these cases, which I think often people forget. I want to ask you about these two. I mean, you worked with Manhattan DA Alvin Bragg. You also worked with Todd Blanch. I joked about a dinner party. That's not going to happen. But what should people like to project onto these prosecutors, who they are, or the defense attorneys? What should people know or understand about each of them, their style, their strengths, as they're watching this trial unfold?
Well, you know, the great thing about being a prosecutor is I had no idea what their political leanings may have been when we were prosecutors together. We didn't discuss it. That is not what a prosecutor's job is. They are both true professionals. DA Bragg will treat this case with the respect that the justice system deserves. He will only speak through his prosecutors in court and court documents. You will not see any press conferences. He will not politicize this. He will let the facts and the evidence speak as to whether they are applied sufficiently to the law to get a conviction. And Todd Blanch is also a professional. He's been a defense lawyer for a while, was an excellent prosecutor. And I think you will see much better defense lawyering from Mr. Blanch than you may have seen in the civil case that Donald Trump had a couple months ago.
I also wanted to ask you just about the jury selection process. We all learned a lot. I became fascinated by the jury selection process today. Who knew? Did anything stick out to you about the number of people who pulled themselves out of it, or the length of the questionnaire? Anything surprising to you?
Well, it's always interesting when people self-select their own biases. You know, I sat for jury duty as a former prosecutor, and I actually had a judge ask me, say, are you sure you can be fair and impartial? Which I found insulting. Of course I can be fair and impartial. Just because I'm a prosecutor does not mean that I can't look at the facts and the evidence like anybody else would. And so I wonder who is actually pulling him or herself out because of bias. Is it bias against Trump? Is it bias for Trump? It's very hard to tell. But I am glad that there will be an exhaustive voir dire of the jurors, because I do think that the sanctity of the jury pool is going to be vital in this trial. This is going to be a model for many Americans as to how criminal trials work, how our country's rule of law operates, and how no person, whether the former president or anyone else, is above the law. Donald Trump will be treated as any other defendant will be. All of his politicization and his partisanship and his campaigning outside of the courtroom will not be allowed in the courtroom. The only thing that will come in will be facts and evidence according to the rule of law, and these jurors will ultimately decide whether or not the evidence proves beyond a reasonable doubt that Donald Trump committed these crimes. That's what our great system is based on. And so now that the trial is actually beginning, as someone who did a number of trials, I'm excited for the American people to actually see how this process should work and why it should apply to Donald Trump and everyone else in this country, no matter their stature or power.
He walked down the same hallway, sat in the same chair as other defendants, which stuck out to me today. Congressman Dan Goldman, thank you so much for making time for us this evening. And coming up, a deep dive into Donald Trump's relationship with David Pecker and the National Enquirer, which loomed large during day one of this trial. And then I'll talk to the former executive editor of the Enquirer. I'm very excited about this conversation, who saw the now infamous catch and kill scheme up close and just wrote about it in a remarkable piece for the New York Times Magazine. Our exclusive interview with Lachlan Cartwright is coming up in just a few minutes, and we'll be right back.
Get the latest updates on this year's high-stakes election with MSNBC's How to Win 2024 newsletter. When you subscribe, you'll get expert analysis on key races sent straight to your inbox, including articles written by the host of the How to Win podcast, Jennifer Palmieri. Subscribe today at MSNBC.com/win.
Hi, everyone. It's Katie Fang. Did you know my weekly show on MSNBC is now available as a podcast? With my decades of experience as a trial lawyer, you'll get an insider's perspective on all things legal. At a time when politics and the law are inextricably intertwined, my guests and I break down what's next and why it matters, both inside and outside the courtroom. Search for The Katie Fang Show wherever you're listening and follow.
Of all the criminal cases facing Donald Trump, and there are many, the one that started today in Manhattan is kind of the Trumpiest, with salacious details about an extramarital affair and hush money payoffs. You'd expect to read about it in a tabloid. And in fact, one particular tabloid, the National Enquirer, figures prominently in the story prosecutors want to tell. It's also a story one insider is now willing to tell. Media reporter Lachlan Cartwright was the number two man in the National Enquirer's newsroom in the lead up to the 2016 election, a very pivotal time in this story. And in a new piece for the New York Times Magazine, he describes that experience in vivid detail. Cartwright says he pursued the story of Dino the doorman, a former employee at Trump Tower, who said he heard a rumor that Trump fathered a love child with a colleague. Cartwright didn't find the story credible, but that didn't deter his bosses. National Enquirer editor Dylan Howard, who you see there on the left, and publisher David Pecker, who's on the right, Cartwright says they paid Dino the doorman $30,000 for exclusive rights to his story. Not to publish it, to kill it. And locked it in a safe where it never saw the light of day. That was when Cartwright says he first heard the term catch and kill. They'd pay a source to tell them, and only them, their story. Then they made sure the story never got told elsewhere. According to Cartwright and to prosecutors, the Enquirer did that multiple times on Trump's behalf, including to silence Karen McDougal, a Playboy playmate with whom Trump allegedly had another affair. She says there's little doubt why the tabloid offered her $150,000 right after Trump became an official party nominee for president.
Why do you think it was that it was after Donald Trump was the Republican nominee that they came back?
They wanted to squash a story.
Through it all, Cartwright says the Enquirer was in constant contact with Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's fixer, who has already done jail time for the payoff to adult actress Stormy Daniels. You know, the thing Trump tried to hide from voters and is now on trial for that started today. This morning, Judge Juan Marchand ruled that prosecutors can tell McDougal's story to the jury, even as this trial is specifically about the payments not to McDougal, but to Stormy Daniels. And they may also call the National Enquirer's CEO and former top editor as witnesses after they both testified to the grand jury. They could help establish that Trump was willing to pay handsomely to bury stories, even those unrelated to the specific charges in this case, that might have negatively impacted his run for president. But the judge also ruled that jurors won't hear some pretty big details of the story, like the fact that Trump's wife, Melania, was pregnant when he had his alleged affair with McDougal, though even that ruling has prompted national media to remind the public of exactly that. We don't know who will be on the jury or how they will rule. We don't know that yet. But this trial and all of the details around it are another reminder of exactly the kind of person Donald Trump is. So how does Lachlan Cartwright, the former executive editor for the National Enquirer, who had a front row seat back then, feel about this case now? I'll ask him when he joins me next. The details that came out of Donald Trump's first criminal trial will be shocking to plenty of Americans, but probably not to my next guest. Lachlan Cartwright helped run the National Enquirer's newsroom, and in a new piece for the New York Times Magazine, he describes what it was like reading the indictment against Trump. He He says, he writes in there, quote, "It was the 13-page statement of facts that brought me to tears. On page 3, prosecutors outlined the catch and kill scheme to suppress negative information. And it revealed to me that I had been managing a newsroom with improvised explosive devices planted everywhere." Lachlan Cartwright joins me now. He's, of course, the former executive editor of the National Enquirer. He's now special correspondent for The Hollywood Reporter. This is such a fascinating piece. I was just telling you, I also listened to your piece on The Daily and heard you talk through it. A lot of people don't even know that this is what happens out there. But I want to start with what I just read. You clearly have been paying very close attention to this case. You know the details very well. You're going to be in the courtroom, I believe. And as someone very intimately aware of the contours here, what do you hope people understand?
Fundamentally, Jen, this is a case about election interference. And I understand people are focusing on a payoff to a porn star. But fundamentally here, this is a case about election interference. We go back to a meeting that took place in August of 2015 with the person I used to work for, David Pecker, where he's with Michael Cohen, and he says, "I will be the eyes and ears of the campaign. Mm-hmm. My organization will purchase negative stories off the market, and we will run negative stories on your rivals." Now, that is something I did not know in real time when I was the executive editor of The Enquirer, when we were orchestrating, you know, operations such as what happened with Dina Sajudin, where mm-hmm. we were trying to stand up this tip about Trump having a love child. And then we suddenly the order came to stand down and we paid him $30,000. And that story never saw the light of day. But ultimately, this organization, this media organization, you've been around politics long mm-hmm. enough to know that it's not unusual for a media organization to do favors for a political sure. candidate or a campaign. But this is the first time in American democracy, certainly that I'm aware of, that a media organization twists itself into a criminal enterprise to help get a candidate elected. And that is what went on here. And that is fundamentally what this case is about.
And that is such an important part of this story, because it's not just about this one particular case. That's what we hear in the courtroom. It's also about the media organization you used to work for really pushing negative stories about a number of people who are Trump's rivals. I mean, stories about his 2016 primary rivals, Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, as well as a slew of negative stories about Hillary Clinton. We all remember kind of these covers, or many of us do. Talk about how basically, and you've touched on it a little bit, this whole entire media organization was set up to protect a single candidate.
Yeah, I mean, I've come from tabloids, in the UK. I worked for the Murdochs for many years, both at The Sun and the New York Post. I'm used to tabloid journalism. This wasn't that. Certainly did not. It merged itself into basically a propaganda arm, where we went from reporting on celebrities or mass shootings, true crime, which is the bread and butter, as is, you know, celebrity, you know, divorces. And suddenly we're now running stories. Hillary has 3 months to live and we're lining up.
I remember that one.
Pseudo experts to analyze, you know, pictures of her looking frail. And our art department is ginning up these images to make her look in poorer health than she was. And it was week after week after week, as one of Trump's rivals was up in the polls, whether it was Ted Cruz or as someone else, we would be running a negative story. And say what you will about the Enquirer, the reach of this publication, it's on, you know, market, supermarket shelves in every Walmart, in every airport. And that real estate was being weaponized by AMI to help get Trump elected. And that is what, you know, Alvin Bragg is talking about in this statement of facts, in this indictment. And that's what I think people sort of pass over a little bit when we talk about falsifying business records. Fundamentally, this was a plot, an agreement to influence the 2016 election, and it worked.
And this is, again, so important because, I mean, I've worked obviously in the side of media when you're working for campaigns, right? And earned media, as they say, magazine covers that are on grocery store shelves, that is gold to people, the visuals of what they're seeing. So we learned today that the judge will allow National Enquirer covers to be admissible in court. We just showed a few of them, including the Hillary Clinton is dying cover. Are there some that you think are important for people to see? Are there some that, you know, you think would particularly make that point?
It's the pattern. It's the pattern to look through what this publication was publishing when I first joined in 2014, when it was, you know, it was Jen and Ben, or it was, you know, Tom Cruise, or it was that kind of mix of celebrity content. And then to look at how this publication then became, as I said, a propaganda tool for the Trump organization, that, you know, it was Hillary that was dying every other week. It was Ted Cruz's father is involved with Lee Harvey Oswald. It was, you know, every other politician is suddenly there's a negative story. And that, again, the catch and kills everyone focuses on, and I get that obsession, but it is looking at how this publication was weaponized and becoming a propaganda tool of the Trump organization. I think that pattern here is incredibly important.
One of the things that's striking to me about all of this is that you've decided to put yourself out there. I mean, you had an NDA.
Which I'm publicly breaking.
Which you're publicly breaking. We all know that there can be threats and even violence.
Which you've experienced.
Talk to me a little about that and how you considered that when you decided to be as public as you have been in telling a very personal story.
I've wanted to tell this story for some years. For a couple of reasons. Firstly, as a journo, it is a cracking yarn, but it is a story of national importance. And secondly, I, as someone who has been pursued, you know, over the years because of you know, my help to media organizations as a source, which is a important part of the New York Times piece, is when I reveal that I was a source for a lot of these organizations, getting out in you know, real time with the Wall Street Journal on the eve of the election, helping get the Karen McDougal story out into the public domain. But I also wrote this story for anyone that is in a tight spot, that is having the screws turned on them, mm-hmm. to know that, you know, at some point they're going to be able to get to the other side of it. And that's what I was able to do. I was able to, after several years, to get to the other side of this. And David Pecker and Dylan Howard, who have written me, you know, a number of very intense legal threats, threatening $5 million lawsuits, I'll be down at court and I'll be able to look them in the eyes and think, you know, I've got out the other side of this, and you blokes are here testifying about, you know, these matters. I wanted to tell this story for some years, and I'm glad that I had this opportunity.
I'm so grateful you're here, and I think it's important to just note, I mean, it is incredibly courageous to tell a story like this because of all of the reasons, not just the NDA, but because of all the threats out there. It's an important story for people to understand about what has happened over the years and how there was an effort to suppress information from the American public. I encourage everybody to read it, listen to it. You can do both. Lack and Cartwright, thank you so much for joining me this evening. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Cheers. Thank you for having me.
And coming up, a preview of my exclusive interview with singer and activist John Legend. You'll hear his thoughts as an advocate for criminal justice reform about Donald Trump's claim that he's a victim of a two-tiered system of justice. We'll be right back. At a time when we're hearing over and over from Donald Trump, and we'll hear it again, and from his allies, that he is somehow the victim of a two-tiered system of justice, it's important to be very clear about one thing. There is one system for the powerful and wealthy, people like Donald Trump, and there's another system for everyone else. But don't take my word for it. I just sat down with someone who has spent the last several years fighting for the people who are actually victims of an unfair justice system, singer and activist John Legend. Listen to his response when I asked him about Trump's claim that he is the victim of a two-tiered justice system.
Well, he is a part of a two-tier system of justice, but not in the way that he thinks he is. Mm-hmm. He is getting way more concessions than the average criminal defendant would get. He's getting delays. He's got access to all kinds of lawyers that are filing this and filing that, delaying every trial. And most people don't have access to that kind of lawyering, don't have access to the kind of concessions that the justice system will provide to you if you can afford it.
If you can afford it. You can catch the rest of my conversation with John Legend this Sunday at noon right here on MSNBC. That does it for me tonight. You can catch the show every Sunday at 12 p.m. and Monday at 8 p.m. on MSNBC. And don't forget to follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. For now, goodbye from Washington, and we'll see you next week.
Stay up to date on the biggest issues of the day with the MSNBC Daily Newsletter. Each morning, you'll get analysis by experts you trust, video highlights from your favorite shows.
2024 is now truly the most important election in the history of our country.
Previews of our podcasts and documentaries, plus written perspectives from the newsmakers themselves, all sent directly to your inbox each morning. Get the best of MSNBC all in one place. Sign up for MSNBC Daily at MSNBC.com.